Every one of us has either experienced a hurricane or a superstorm firsthand or knows someone who has. We've all seen them in the media, homes and businesses destroyed, whole towns wiped off the map, city coffers drained to help people. In 2017 alone, the United States spent $307 billion, with a B, on disaster relief from a combination of property damage, spending on aid and relief, according to Business Insider. We've had two extreme weather events costing over $1 billion in 2019 already, and 10 or more are expected to happen, according to NOAA. We've already seen mid-spring blizzards in North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, Wyoming, and Colorado. So what can you do to protect your home or business or community? What kind of planning should you do? How can you tell what the damage might be or how vulnerable you are? Today, we're going to find out from one of the foremost experts in the field who gave a superb training on these issues that I attended recently. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we bring you insights and tips from remarkably innovative women, particularly about corporate responsibility, energy, sustainability-related issues. We talk about innovation, leadership, technologies, and careers, always bringing a new perspective. I'm Joan Michelson. Find us anywhere you like to listen to podcasts and on our website, greenconnectionsradio.com, and through my Forbes blog as well. And please pass it on to your friends. If you want to gain insight from more women like me and our accomplished guests, join one of our mastermind groups. We'll help you with contacts, resources, strategies, ideas, and tips to save you time and money as you grow your career or your business, no matter what industry you're in. I'd like you to meet Rawlings Miller, a climate scientist who is principal in WSP, a huge global consulting firm, where she is a leader in their resilience and sustainability advisory services in the United States. Rawlings has about 20 years of experience in climate change and air pollution research and policy, including in assessments of climate impacts on national programs and policies, climate change-related hazard and vulnerability analyses, and climate adaptation planning. She has worked with various government agencies, cities, and policymakers, too numerous to list here. She earned her PhD in atmospheric sciences, get that, from Arizona University, her master's degree in aerospace engineering from Boston University, which, by the way, is my sister's alma mater, and her bachelor's degree in physics from Union College. And frankly, Rawlings has such a great communication style. When I attended her climate resilience planning training at the Climate Leadership Conference recently, that I knew I had to have you meet her. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, Rawlings, and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thanks so much for inviting me. It's really great to talk with you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Having an emergency fund is one of the things that all financial management experts recommend. But it has completely new meaning when I talk to somebody like you. I mean, in the days of climate change, it seems like we also have to have an emergency fund that takes into consideration having to rebuild in a natural disaster. We might need it if we get flooded out or the wind rips the roof off or carries our house off like in The Wizard of Oz or something, or a fire unexpectedly sweeps through our neighborhood. I mean, these are all extremely frightening, really. And I don't want to scare people, but I think we need to face the facts and prepare for them. I mean, the good news is we can prepare for them, right?
Right. No, that's exactly right. And I think at your beginning of this, when you were talking about the recent events that really show how vulnerable our communities are to weather events and the concern that we're seeing a growing trend, whether it's we're building more in harm's way or, you know, whether there's the response to a changing climate that's impacting our communities. And so if we were to follow along with what the science is suggesting is that this is going to become worse. And if we don't do anything, we're really putting ourselves further into harm's way, amplifying those impacts that can really have really consequential and catastrophic impacts. And I do think that the way that you look at the emergency fund before, it has always been more in a response recovery mode where the event happens and now how are you going to get back to business as usual? While we're starting to see more, particularly over the past decade, many of the more progressive communities are ones that keep getting repetitively hit year mm-hmm. after year, mm-hmm. they're really starting to look more towards how do we cope? How do we make ourselves more resilient to these events we're either exposed to or there's a very strong likelihood that in the near future we are going to be?
Well, I mean, that's absolutely right. And there are a million questions in what you just said that I want to get into. But give us an idea of some of the hits that these economies take. I mean, what is the economic hit that most communities that you've worked with take from natural disasters? I mean, obviously, coastal communities, for example, usually have tourism as a huge revenue stream. So mm-hmm. if they're hit with a disaster like Florida was in 2017, for example, and many times before, actually, but the whole state's economy takes a hit and tax revenues are way, way down as a result. So how do you measure or what's your experience with the actual, put a number on it?
Right, right. So that's when you really start getting into, you know, the event and then what are the consequences that are impacting the community, you know, during and post event. And so that can be things, as you just mentioned, tourism, which not only the coastal communities, but you have other areas that, you know, might have riverine flooding that has happened to them or other types of, you know, strong events. You have industry with the supply chain, where you can have an interruption, particularly with a lot of the shifting that some industries have done with your manufacturing, where they don't have the warehouses anymore that store goods ready to go to, you know, the Target store, but instead they may be using their supply chain in a way that is most cost effective to them and skipping over having that storage site nearby, in which case if they get cut off because of an event, whether it's the rails or the roadways, you know, the truckers and the freight, if they get cut off, that those supplies are not going to get there. And those communities, particularly in that type of situation, really need them. And so it has this sort of, you know, positive feedback of, you know, bad onto bad. You also have military mobilization. So if you have situations where you, and this can even happen, you know, right now with Hampton Roads, for example, they have nuisance flooding along one of the primary roadways to get to one of their big facilities there. And people know during certain higher high tides, they're not going to be able to necessarily cross that roadway or, you know, and get to work. And so they prepare ahead of time and they anticipate that, but they shouldn't have to be doing that. You know, we want our military to be able to mobilize. And that just also goes to like communities that, you know, need to get to work, that they can't work remotely and they're paid by the hour. If they can't get that, you know, that work done, if they can't get paid, that's going to have a ripple within, say, the local five and dime around the corner that is expecting them to, you know, come in and purchase milk or whatever it might be. So it is very much an event happens, but the consequences really ripple out and can have really large economic consequences across.
Right. And when people come back to their businesses, they don't know what they're going to find. So,
correct. Correct.
Yes. Tell us a story. I mean, I have a client who did an economic analysis of one community, and it's a smallish coastal community, and they were ready to take, they predicted they would be taking about a $3 billion hit in, I think it was like 10 feet of sea rise or sea level rise, for example, which is not that much. I mean, it's a ton of money for not a lot of sea rise. So give us a couple of stories about, you know, some communities you worked with and how they, you know, what kinds of economic hits, some dollar amounts that you've run into.
If you were to raise your house because of a coastal flood, so you're trying to put it up to a certain elevation. Actually, it's interesting. I was just looking at numbers this morning because we're doing some work in Miami-Dade. And that can run, you know, anywhere for a small house, you know, maybe 50,000 up to a larger house, you know, maybe 250,000. Mm-hmm. So if you take that, and you multiply it across your communities, that can get quite, you know, quite high quite quickly. We've also come across, like, there was a study that I tapped into that more sort of demonstrated during Hurricane Katrina that a large amount of the costs that of the damages to buildings, to residents, to businesses, a lot of that isn't going to be supported by the insurance or by, you know, direct just government aid that you don't pay back. But there's a lot of loans that get created out of that. And so you can have a significant portion of the actual cost being out of pocket by the citizen or the business.
Wow.
Which, you know, can be great for the people giving out the loans, but can really be a significant hit for the people that are having to take out these loans unexpectedly.
Well, yeah, it's debt that they didn't plan to incur, for one thing. And then you also have the agricultural hit. I mean, obviously, you know, and that ripples through the entire economy. I mean, when Florida got hit and the South in general got hit and all those agricultural communities, you know, that just, I think the cost of oranges and avocados went like sky high or something. It was just insane. So let's jump into planning. So let's say a community or a business comes to you and says, you know, we've seen the news reports of these other communities and businesses being unprepared for the consequences, and we don't want that to be us. Where do you tell them to start?
Right. And so the first thing to do is to really sort of think through what has happened in the past or recently. And there's different information that's out there that's readily available. Every state has a hazard mitigation plan. And in that, we'll really identify different hazards, both natural and man-made, that have been observed. And you can usually use that information to get a sense of how likely it is within the state. And then there are some plans that break it up. So you can even look within the region that you're located. If you're a business that has, you know, multiple locations, then that sort of just expands the discovery period. But you need to get a sense of what those hazards are that are, you know, most probable to occur. And then
what's the name of those plans again?
So there's hazard mitigation plans.
Okay.
And so you get from that, you sort of can pull out those hazards. And then you also need to have an understanding of how what you care about in your business is going to be affected by the hazard. So you need to sort of think through what are the key elements in my system. So if you're a business and you do have, you know, certain rail lines that you're relying on, that you've got certain warehouses in certain locations, you've got stores, or, you know, whether there's a headquarters that you're focused on and you have populations that are living around it. So you need to sort of geographically identify where these physical elements are within your business that you care about, and overlay that with the hazards, just get some sense of where there's been exposure. And you can also further that along to have conversations with people within your business, maybe the manager of that manufacturing warehouse, you know, whoever it might be, to say, okay, these events have happened recently. What happened here? And that gives you that ad hoc evidence of it was a problem. We had flooding and we're concerned it's going to happen again. That if we got the same level of flooding, yes, we haven't done anything about it. Or it might be that the physical structures were fine, but the lifeline sectors, the energy, the transportation, the water, the communication, something amongst them went out. Maybe it was a very bad heat event and the energy supply, you know, you had brownouts and blackouts, and that had a direct impact because you didn't have any redundancy within your energy system. You didn't have another way to get power, you know, under the emergency condition. So you tease out just the exploratory piece and discovery of really how have you been and will be exposed. And that in and of itself can be really a really beneficial exercise for just preparing for today and getting some like just real quick strategies in place for those elements that really had a big, you know, impact on your bottom line. So that's the first step, is just that identification.
I think I might have mentioned to you when we met, I actually lived in North Dakota for 2.5 years. And first of all, they're perpetually prepared for disaster, right? Because you can have a blizzard. In fact, they have blizzards
now.
In the introduction. Yeah. We had an incident in our plant where a water main broke and ultimately flooded part of our building. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the Red River overflowing. It was just a water main, but it was a lesson in what can happen.
Right.
Right. So is that the kind of thing you're thinking?
Yeah.
Of?
Okay. It is. And I mean, if you like sort of further specifics might be an easy one. It's like the transportation system. So you had around Boston. So I'll say you had a nor'easter come through and you had terrific winds. And so the power lines went down on, you know, certain roadways. Not only did you lose the power, but you lost that road segment. And if that was a road segment that, you know, was really critical to the community and one that they use quite often to be able to get, say, from their town to the highway or to a hospital, that's a really important piece of information that you need. If it ends up that they rebuilt the electrical system and the wiring similar to how it had been, the trees weren't, you know, were still potentially, you know, problematic if another windstorm would come. So you pretty much built back as it was and there wasn't any changes, then that's something that you really do need to be aware of to be able to identify that that's an action item that you'll have to deal with those trees. Or, you know, like putting lines underground is expensive and has some of its own things you have to think through. But, you know, at least the trimming of the trees can be one that you would put front and center. So yeah, no, that's exactly right. You really need to get a sense of what's important in your system to you. And is it also exposed to different types of events, whether they're, you know, hurricanes, whether you're in an area that has strong tornadoes or, you know, propensity towards them, whether it's coastal flooding, whatever the hazard might be.
Mm-hmm. And look at the NOAA reports, frankly, because they've got some really good predictive models. In your presentation, you talked a lot about the need for communities and businesses and government to work together on mm-hmm. these issues. They each also have their own agenda, and they each have their own money, and everybody wants you to use everybody else's money, not your own. So how do you do that? What are the realities of that, and how do you resolve the inherent conflict, especially when you've got different, you know, political parties and orientations? You may have, you know, a progressive legislature and a Republican governor, or vice versa, for example.
Sure. I've lived through what you're describing right now. I'm working on studies with all different types of walks of life and personalities. What I found to be most effective, if you're going in there and you're doing an assessment when it comes to whether it's climate change, weather hazards, and you're trying to really get a sense of how the community or a sector that everybody really relies on, like, you know, water, is going to be impacted, is to really do a good job communicating the information and the state of practice and science so that everyone has a level playing field going into it. So you've described well without, you know, there's no advocacy part of this or anything else. You're just showing them what the state of science shows. And so this is where the trends have been. This is the increase we may have seen in, you know, certain extreme events, precipitation events or riverine flooding or, you know, extreme heat. And these are trends that we've seen so far. So first, I think the first step is that you just make sure that the information is there, is communicated well, and it's done in a way that is very impartial. And then during the conversations, a lot of times what I've seen is people that have come into the conversation feeling very rigid and forced into it and not really wanting to participate. When they see the information, it creates a need for them to talk with each other. So you have the businesses that are starting to see, not only from a personal perspective, because they generally live in the area and they have, you know, families around or people they care about, they also see it from the business perspective and what that is going to mean to them expanding or changing or evolving, you know, over the next 20 or 30 years. And then you have it from the community perspective that start to see sort of those ripples of how it affects them. So they each come into it when they see the information from their own angle of how does this impact me? But they realize that it's a bigger deal because it tends to be pretty diverse across the community as a whole. And that creates that need to work together.
Yeah, I just want to touch on this a little bit, and you alluded to it, but I just want to point it out, which is communication is such a huge issue. You know, we need to have kind of a crisis communication plan in place. I mean, every business needs to have one anyway, but especially for these kinds of disasters. And what are you going to do when X, Y, and Z is down? You brought up in your presentation this great chart of steps. I have a graphic that I'm going to mm-hmm. post with the blog in particular and probably on our website as well with it. But it's that methodology mm-hmm. slide mm-hmm. that you have: identify, assess, strategize, prioritize, and implement.
You've identified what in your system is problematic, you just identified your system and how hazards might impact it. You've assessed what within your system is going to be at risk of different types of hazards. You then try to strategize, well, for those that are at risk, that are really important to the system, what do I do about that? And how soon do I need to do something about it? And how much is it going to cost? What type of, you know, strategies do I have to sort of think through? And then of the sort of the universe of different strategies that might be appropriate, which are the ones that are most important for us to do first and second, and for not only in terms of the timescale of when you're going to do it, but what are you protecting and what's most important to the, you know, whether it's the community, whether it's your employees, whether it's your business, whether it's, you know, a community as a whole. So at that point, you have identified in sort of what would be the plan, the different actions to move forward with. And, you know, ideally you've put in there sort of different roles and responsibilities of who actually is responsible for those particular actions. And throughout this whole process, as you'll see on the slide, you've engaged with community and those important stakeholders as much as possible through, so that when you get to this stage and you've got your actions, it's all really well understood how you got to where you are and you've gotten buy-in through it. It's not as, you can still move forward without it, but it's just so much easier. So that's when we sort of see this, you know, the climate resilience plan can be really put into that report, all that information. Then the next step is implementing. And so that's actually going out and checking out, maybe you have to move some type of building and you're going out and you're checking out, where do I want to move it and how am I going to do it? So you're working through those prioritized actions. That can take, you know, years, many years post. Once you've done that and you've started to try to implement those actions, you want to get some sense of what's working. And so you put an action into place and you sort of say, okay, is that strategy helping to reduce the exposure to the hazard, reduce the consequence to that impact, like whatever that strategy is supposed to do, is it being effective? And if it's not, why isn't it? Is it because we actually don't have the support that we thought we would for that strategy? Maybe it's a communication piece. Maybe it's something physical where you've set up a seawall and it's actually not as effective as you thought it would be for a particular community. So you set up these performance measures to get some sense of what's working and what's not. At which point, you know, maybe it's 5 years or 10 years down the line, you reassess it and you look at those performance measures, you see how they're working, you see how those actions have been evolving, you see if the science has changed. And if any of those sort of you check the box, or if your system itself has started to really change, your population has changed, for example, or your customers have changed, you'll want to go back and reassess. And you can, you know, many times borrow a lot of that information. You're not starting from scratch, but you're building on what you have. And so it becomes this cycle. And that sort of, in sometimes that cycle, when you go from implementing to going back to assessing, there may be certain milestones, like you may have a long range plan that your, say, transportation agency does every, you know, 5-10 years, or you may have a community plan that you've already promised to revisit in 7 years. And so those can be natural milestones that you incorporate for this reassessment, or it can just be that you're starting to see some significant changes in your system, or the actions that you thought were going to be effective just aren't.
Well, and you can even see that in a city budget that has to be done, or a state budget all the time. A couple more questions that I want to ask you about you, but are there funding sources for these rebuilding efforts, for these planning efforts, I mean?
Yeah, so FEMA has recently come out with a funding effort, and I can't get into the details, but they are looking at it more from a preparedness perspective. So
it's not just,
you know, rebuild to how it was, but it's getting into identifying potential threats that are, you know, problematic and trying to think through what to do about it. You also have, like, within states, California, Massachusetts are two, for example, that are pretty progressive. Massachusetts right now has their vulnerable communities program where you can apply for and get funding from the state to really start to tease out what the potential hazards are to your community and what steps you might want to take to be moving forward. I haven't seen it so much on the actionable side where they're actually supporting the implementation of the strategy. But you can do things like, you know, like New York City and some other locations and states have done, where they're now starting to look at design standards and how do we want to change those design standards? What's the guidance we're giving if you're building something that's going to have a long lifetime? If it's exposed to coastal flooding, or it's right along the sea level, or right along the coastal line, you should be thinking about what's the sea level rise for that location in 2050 or 2060. And so there's a lot more going on where there's just in sort of the business practice of building, repairing, fact that it's trying to incorporate resilience into the design, into the construction. You know, it's definitely more pockets across the country where you see this, opposed to it being across the country. But it is starting to begin, and there's becoming more sort of considerations of how do we take the money that we have and start to move towards that sort of resilient place that we want to be.
On the positive side, I would imagine that these communities can use this planning and the strategies and the even especially rebuilding, but as a way to upgrade their infrastructure, become more energy efficient, lower their carbon footprint, as well as increase their resilience and help the communities.
You're starting to see this sort of evolution towards thinking green. Because we have, I mean, I know I've got colleagues where I work where there's definitely a growing expanse of the green infrastructure, whether it's buildings.
I want to ask you a couple of career things. Tell me about a time, mid-career, whatever that feels like to you, when you had to make a career decision that in retrospect feels like a turning point. What that decision was, how you made it, and how you feel about it now.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, there's been a number of those, I think. I haven't been one that has like a mapped out my whole professional life. I tend to sort of go by intuition and sort of determine when to make changes based on, you know, sort of seeking out new challenges, I think, in a lot of cases. And in other cases where I look for the balance between I'm giving as much to the work I'm doing in the job as the place I'm working is giving to me. Like you sort of, you know, want that type of balance just to feel valued, I think. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but I think, you know, from a professional perspective, it's definitely been when I was an aerospace engineer and I was working as a defense engineer, and it just didn't feel quite right. I love like air motion and how it, you know, and studying how it moves. I love at the time I was doing a lot of modeling. I'm a big computer modeler. I love that. But it felt, and when I tell people about the job that I was doing, because it was defense engineering at a very high scale, it sounded pretty cool. In retrospect, it just wasn't quite the right fit. And so for whatever reason, this is before, you know, like the web was out there where you could really investigate everything possible. For some reason, I just turned towards atmospheric sciences. And, you know, obviously climate modeling was something I was really interested in because it was that climate modeling and the physics and sort of everything was pulled together into one place. And so that was something where I think that was a turning point because it put me in the right direction.
That was an intuitive decision that you made? You just like felt something wasn't singing for you. So you've had such an interesting career and you're still in some ways midway through because I just believe
that. Let's hope not
good. Well, no, but I really do. I mean, and I've met you too, so that factors into it. But what would you suggest to a woman who is mid-career, say, you know, at least 10 years of experience, maybe 15 or whatever it feels like, who wants to use her education and her experience to make a difference. And, you know, she has a passion for making a difference, who also wants to get ahead and make more money, you know, is ambitious. What advice would you have for her?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think there's probably a few different pieces that at least have worked for me. So I can speak to that. One of them is just really old fashioned. It's just, you know, hard work. I've found that it's as important or more so than just sort of a natural intelligence. And to really, you know, do that hard work, you need to be passionate about what you're doing. And you need to be one of those, it needs to be something where you're walking the dog on a Saturday and you're still thinking about it, not because it's stressing you out, but because you're fascinated by it. And so that type of sort of hard work in an area that really you feel fulfilled, I think is a critical component. At least that's what I have found for, you know, feeling successful in, you know, your own career and in your own, you know, sort of skin. I think another thing is that listening to people, I really have felt throughout the process. And I think a lot of this has come just from learning and being part of stakeholder engagement processes, where really everyone has something important to contribute. And it can be a little challenging at times to tease that out with certain personalities. And at other times you need to be patient. But if you can really listen, that I've found to be something, and I have to sometimes remind myself, and I do some things on the side sometimes when I'm on long calls and I'm not necessarily engaging except in certain moments to make sure that I stay engaged throughout, that I'm really listening throughout. Because if you do that, it keeps you also learning because you're hearing people and you're hearing new perspectives. You also, though, it almost protects you if, say, you're talking to your client and you're really listening to what they want. So many times I've been in situations where the client is saying something and people aren't listening appropriately to what is being asked for. So that will lead to providing something that really is a disconnect. And so you really, and for some people, it can be, I think, problematic to listen because not only it takes patience, but you have to be relaxed and you have to be sort of comfortable to really be able to listen. So, you know, whether that means for some that tends to be more sort of anxiety ridden, do a little yoga before, or I find exercise is critical to sort of that calm mind to really listen. That's something that I think can really help from a professional perspective because you're paying attention and you're hearing what's wanted. And you can still have that dialogue of, okay, you're saying this, but you might consider this because what you know, that's going to meet your goals better. And so you can have that conversation. But really, again, that listening is important. And it also, it allows you as I'm, you know, that second piece of questioning what you're hearing. And so if you listen well and you're humble enough to realize you're not, you know, the smartest person in the room, that everybody is smart in their own their capacity, you're able to then feel comfortable asking the questions opposed to just thinking, oh, I should know this. Oh, okay, I'm going to write this down and go home and figure it out. I mean, there are some people professionally that you don't want to question because they seem to like fixate on that. So you have to be a little bit selective in how you do that. But for most people I've worked with, you ask the questions because you're listening. They give you the responses and it creates both a really good dialogue, but it helps you grow your knowledge and your understanding.
Oh, that's so important. Well, I can tell you, being an interviewer for a living, it certainly makes a difference. You definitely learn to listen, that's for sure. And I also think that you have to let people surprise you. And read between the lines, because sometimes, like you were saying, that kind of listen for what they want to get across. It doesn't always come out exactly in the words that they're using, but you have to sort of read between the lines. And it also depends on what their relationship is to you, because some people can say it would be really nice if X, and what that really is a command. It's not,
I think that's
not
right.
Really a request. But that's great. That's great advice.
There's also one more thing that for women out there that are sort of 10 or 15 years into it, and this may be, you know, across gender, but, you know, there are times where you see people that do extremely well, but they're stuck and they're really valuable to their employers doing what they're doing now. And that's where they're going to be. And in order for them, if they're happy with that, fantastic. But if they're feeling ambitious in a way that they're not getting out of the job what they need, and they sort of are starting to feel like, you know, that they're not moving in the direction that they want to go, there are times where you have to make a leap of faith and go to another situation or a position and, you know, try to be as smart and all that as you can be. And so you have to sort of make those choices, you know, like, am I happy with how things are, or are there certain things that I'm finding really frustrating and just aren't working for me now? And I need to think through, how am I going to move this forward, whether it's internally and sort of changing your perspective of who you're working with to continue your growth, or whether it's making that move.
Oh, that's a really good point. And it's, you know, weighing the consequences. And sometimes you can have put a side hustle together to help you work through that. But you just have to be careful. I did a story on this too, and a really interesting interview with an IP attorney, intellectual property attorney, because you have to be careful of your employment agreement. Your employer might own your side hustle depending on your employment agreement.
Interesting.
But you can explore something on the side to see if maybe it's just a temporary thing, or maybe your boss is a jerk. But I think it's important to have people that you can learn from around you. Mm-hmm. That you are helping to grow, but that you're helping to grow them, but then they're also helping to grow you and helping you think differently. And
yeah, absolutely.
That's a big part for me anyway of feeling fulfilled.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. You've been great. It's been really fun.
Yeah, no, this has been very fun. I feel like we could talk for a few more hours.
I know. I do too. It's funny. So thank you so much for joining us today on Green Connections Radio. Rawlings Miller, Principal in the Resiliency and Sustainability Advisory Services at WSP. I'll put some of your graphics on the website with this because I just love them. I have way too many pictures from your presentation. So do you have a climate resilience plan? Why or why not? Tweet it to us at John Michelson or post it on our Facebook page and like the page while you're there and ask to join our private Facebook group or email it to us at info@greenconnectionsradio.com. Find us online anywhere you like to listen to podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, whatever, or at our website, greenconnectionsradio.com, and pass it on to your friends. If you want to gain insight from more women like us, join one of our Green Connections Mastermind groups, and we'll help you with contacts, resources, strategies, ideas, and tips to save you time and money and save you from some of those work situations we've been describing as you grow your career or your business, no matter what field you're in. I'm Joan Michelson. Thank you for joining us. See you next time.
Check out some podcasts from one of our new sponsors. About a dozen great shows focused on lifestyle industries on Mouth Media Network, with top brand executives, industry leaders, and innovators in fashion, beauty, travel, real estate, content creation, and even spirituality industries and more. Check out Mouth Media Network, powered by Sennheiser, on iTunes, Google Play, and at mouthmedianetwork.com.